before I start this. Let me put this on pause. Radha, thank you for the wonderful teachings. These words, fullness and emptiness, are they essentially implying the same thing? Of course, the word emptiness is a word, shunyata, that's used by the Buddhist community. And it's a very important word, shunyata, because the word does mean emptiness, but it often translated as a void. It can mean that also, so, but then the void is translated often as, or emotionally, mentally translated as non-existence. So to say shunyata as emptiness, which does not mean non-existence, and if it doesn't mean non-existence, then emptiness has to mean existence free of everything. Existence which is empty. If you say existence which is empty, you can say from a Vedantic standpoint, it's free of nama-rupa. It's free of all name and form. And in fact, Nagarjuna, who is a famous Madhyamaka Mahayana Buddhist, what he says is, he has a little quote where he says that the shunyata, the paramarthika shunyata, the absolute nature of shunyata, is that which is empty of all name and form. The vyavaharika, the empirical meaning of shunyata, is that which is, all the empirical means all these names and forms, everything that, all this duality, all this manifest duality. This manifest duality, all these nama-rupa, name and form, is free of essence. It itself has no essence. So now, if this, so shunyata, this is shunyata, means this world that we experience has no essence. The paramarthika, the absolute shunyata, has no name and form. And so, in the Buddhist world, that was for. So in the Buddhist world, the satya mitya that is implied by that is not at all clear. Because if you say that all of this world, it has no essence, then okay, it has no essence, but then there's something called shunyata that is free of name and form, and the two are not brought together. Right? If you bring them together, then the shunyata, paramarthika shunyata, the absolute emptiness, is Brahman. And the vyavahara, the empirical shunyata, is mitya, because it itself has no being, it has no essence. And since everything that we experience does have being, it is, as long as it's there, then that isness does not belong to the vyavahara, to the empirical reality. It is the very nature of Brahman and all of these names and forms which have no being of their own, right, which are the empirical emptiness, enjoy only the being of Brahman. So with that little explanation, to me, from a, say, a Vedantic perspective, the shunyata as emptiness, the paramarthika, the absolute emptiness, is Brahman, is what they're referring to. And the essencelessness of this creation, which we can, Buddhists experience, and they have a very good way of neti neti, not this, not this, dividing everything, showing that there's really nothing here. There's only conglomerates that are infinitely divisible. We have exactly the same logic to show that there is no thing here to be found. Buddhists do it exactly the same way, right? And so that shunyata, we agree with, but call it mitya, bringing that shunyata together with this shunyata, and we don't use the word shunyata. But you have to remember, this is also, I think, really important, whether we're looking at Eastern traditions, like the Buddhist Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta, all of the Indian darshanas, Sankhya Yoga, they all come out of the same Vedic vision, whether or not they're rejected or not. Like the Bauta doesn't accept the Vedas as a pramana, and yet they come out of Vedic soil. Okay? And similarly, in the West, Christianity, Protestantism, Catholicism, Judaism, you know, all of these, even the Muslims, all are Western-based. They have a biblical foundation, right? And so all of their beliefs and everything are kind of rooted in that biblical foundation. So they're very different. The Judeo-Christian view of reality, which is biblically based, and then the Hindu darshanas, which are based in the Vedas, whether accepted or rejected, it doesn't matter, they still are rejecting the Vedas, not the Bible, right? The Bible is not the Bible, or the Protestants aren't rejecting the Vedas, they're rejecting certain interpretations, and the Jews are rejecting certain interpretations of the Bible. They don't accept the New Testament, but it's the New Testament they don't accept, not the Vedas. You see what I mean? So that whether positive or negative, they're still coming out of the same soil. Mm-hmm. So that being the case, in even understanding all of that, all of the different religions of the world, even the indigenous traditions, are still equally held by one reality. And so whether it's a Western commentary on this one reality that is there, what actually is, or whether it's Eastern or indigenous, it is still based upon the human experience of this world that we live in, both the external world and the internal world that we live in. And the archetypal structure of our psyche, the human psyche, it's still based in this same reality and is a commentary and an explanation of the same reality. And so that's why when, like the Buddha or with Nagarjuna uses, I meant Nagarjuna, not the Buddha, uses a term like shunyata, the shunyata is actually describing something which is there to be described. You know? And so they're going to be just using the word shunyata, describing it in a little different way, but they're describing the same thing. That's why I can say what they're describing in their way is what we call Brahman and Nitya. Because their description fits what we, their description fits what we're describing by those words. That makes sense? So. What is love? Well, love is certainly one of the most important and fundamental words that we have, you know, in our available to us. In fact, often in my classes at CIS, I have a spiritual counseling class, and I have a class in non-duality, Advaita Vedanta class in non-duality, class in spiritual counseling, another type of Vedanta class. And one of the things I will ask everybody before we even start is, you know, what is their highest value? What are they trying to achieve in life? What are they trying to achieve personally for themselves? And I would say 95% of their answers, then we go around and everybody talks about it, yeah, but 95% of the answers involves love directly, immediately, where the word even comes up. And the other 5% are kind of outliers pointing at the same thing. So if you say, well, what kind of person do you want to be? You could say something like, I want to be a loving person. I want to be a caring person. You can say, if you go into what you want for yourself, I want to feel loved. I want to feel whole and complete, and I want to be able to love others, to care for others. You know, that's, you might say a lot of different things, but it's usually circling around that value. So now, the value of love, or the meaning of the word love, can't be your highest value if the experience of love isn't known. So we all know what it is to love, to be loved, to care, to have compassion. These are all just different forms of love. And so we have direct, immediate experience of the word. And we experience it in many different situations. We experience it as though we're being receiving it, or that we're giving it. Whether we're giving it or receiving it, we're still feeling that lovedness. Okay. Now the thing is, so we have the experience, but the experience we have always is time bound. You know, it would be nice if you just feel love, and that it's unshakable, you know. And so we would like to just love, just to feel love, to be loved, not worry about it, not worry about losing it, just to be that. And in fact, when we feel that, we feel the most at home with ourselves. And so that's a direct, immediate experience. The problem is that we don't know how to get it to be permanent. It's still slippery. But as we study, we find that the very, what we call the swarupa, as we study the Vedanta, the Upanishads, as we start to learn to see, what we call the very swarupa means the very nature of the Atma, of the Self, is love. It is not a love, the type of love that's manifest in a quiet mind or loving mind, where that's like a vritti, a thought modification of love, for like when you're, and you can have different degrees of love depending upon the peacefulness of your mind and the relationship that is bringing out that expression that we call love. But that type of a thought modification tends to come and go. But the source of that love and the nature of that love that we experience really is the nature of your own being. Now, what is a little challenging, because the mind is not always enjoying enough shanti, enough peace for that love experience to be manifest in the mind. So the mental love state, I'll call it. It's a state of mind in which love is as though manifest. But the nature of yourself is that love is there all the time, right now. It's right there to be recognized right now. It's not covered by your thoughts or by your positive or negative. It's not covered at all. It's your very nature. But when we're talking about it as your very nature, it is something which is constantly present. And it doesn't have bells and whistles, you know. It's not pervading the mind. It's pervading the mind and pervading all experiences. But the mind is contributing continually its own affect, like sorrow or worry or distress of one kind or another. And the mind often is not just like a clean slate of glass. And so the wholeness of your being, which I would call love, is always there illumining those mental states. But sometimes the mental states are on the negative spectrum of emotion or in the dull spectrum of emotion. And I have, until I get used to discerning these changing emotional states from the one who's aware of them, the conscious being that I am, that natural, subtle, taken for granted me, right, is not appreciated, even though very much there. But what you find really is the very, very source of the love that is manifest in different ways in the mind is really your own being. And in fact, we call it love just in terms of empirical reality. The more your mind settles down and gains a different level of shanti, the more that love is naturally present in the mind, in the mental condition of the mind. You know, like agitation is present as a mental condition of the mind when the mind is stressed. Or hatred is present in the mind as a mental condition when something has really, as though, taken away my happiness. If I believe that someone or something is responsible for taking away, robbing me of my happiness, I can feel dislike or hatred or despair or despondency, you know, these negative spectrum. And then I, this very pure, simple wholeness, illumines that state of mind. With the mind is shiny, clean, then my same me is illumining that shiny, clean mind. So we use an example that I've used even for my clients, my patients in therapy. So it's useful way beyond even Vedanta. Is the example of the sun, bright sun, shining in three water buckets. So it's the water bucket story. You know, where one water bucket is filled with muddy water, and one is filled with kind of an agitated, moving water. And the third one is filled with bright, clear, pristine, clear, still water. And the sun is shining in all three of those. And the muddy water feels the sun, the reflection of the sun is so dim. And the muddy water feels, you know, despair and depression. I'm so unhappy. You know, I don't even feel like living. I'm barely alive. The sun is barely. I don't feel like myself at all. Because from the standpoint of the water, the sun isn't really manifest in that water very well, because of the mud. And in the agitated bucket, the person says, "I'm so," because of the reflection of the sun is all breaking up. You know, I'm so agitated. I'm so upset. I just can't be with myself. I can't sit still. I'm so agitated. And then in the clear water bucket, the person feels, "I feel so much love. I feel so whole and so complete. I'm so happy. I always just want to be like this." Because in that water, the reflection of the sun resonates. It's not the same, but it resonates with the sun. So now imagine I as the conscious being, I'm the sun. I'm never changing whether I'm illumining a muddy water bucket or an agitated water bucket or a clean water, clear water bucket. Nothing ever happens to me. And I don't mind at all. If it's muddy, agitated, doesn't make any difference. But until the water recognizes the sun, that the self is the sun, and that these states are not harming me, it's going to be totally identified. And that's what happens with us. My mind, whatever state the mind is in, I'm totally identified with it. I don't recognize my own self as changeless and illumining it. I don't recognize my own nature, which is so whole and complete and full. And so as you gain knowledge, then it's such a relief for your mind. Because when your mind gets in one of these muddy states or agitated states, it just comes home to the self, which is its own being, and just take dives in and then relaxes in the ananda of my own being, you know. And also, as you become clear in your knowledge, these different states of mind, all of them are just mithya. You just accept them, it's fine, you're feeling bad, you can be with me. I'll give some meditations like that. I love this one meditation, which I'm sure we'll do it in this 10 days and others like it, where your mind is agitated or angry or upset with somebody, you know, whatever. You can just say, "It's okay, you can be with me. I love you. Be with me." When you do that, you know, we welcome whatever the state of mind is, whatever it is, it's okay, you can be with me. Mind feels so relieved. It's not being rejected, because usually what's happening, if you don't like the state, you just want to get rid of it, or you get angry that you're feeling that way, and then you're building all of these other negative thoughts around it, and the pressure is getting worse. You're getting more and more down. But if you don't do that, if you don't push it away, and you just say, "It's okay, because it's this, whatever, for whatever reason, you've become upset, it's okay, you just come and be with me. Then the mind just comes and it has somebody there who loves it. He's not pushing it away. You know? And then the mind relaxes in that state. And the terrible pain goes away because the mind is relaxing. Right? What's causing the mind to have the pain in the first place is its pressure. Then you have all of these other thoughts coming, making more pressure. You know? Another thing, and we'll do this in more depth as we move on, but even if somebody you don't like is in your coming into your vicinity, or you're having to deal with them, and it's a person that you'd really rather never see again in your life, you'd be much happier. They would just absolutely disappear. That would be better. Okay. But when you feel that way, the mind is actually carrying that person inside, because there's a tension inside where you really don't want to have to deal with them, and there's an underlying fear that they're going to be hounding you in one way or another, or be coming into your space and ruining your life because you really can't tolerate. You can't tolerate who they are, what they've done, what's happened in your own circle with those people, or whatever. And so what you can do as an experiment is when an image or thought of that person comes up, you just say, oh, okay, it's okay, you can be with me. That doesn't always work. Sometimes you say, it's okay, you can be with me, and then just allow that person to be there and let your mind relax, purposefully relax in the presence of that person. Sometimes you can do that, it's very beautiful, but sometimes the person who cannot tolerate that person being will say, what are you talking about? Then you say, no, you be with me first. Yeah. It's like you have to put on the oxygen, your own oxygen mask first, and then you can take care of your own. But it's still, it's a really good exercise to, instead of always pushing away or rejecting what you don't like, to accept it. Accept it means that not acting out on some adharma or some way, but accepting the thought that you're having or the feeling that you're having, accepting it, not pushing it away, and then trying to help. You know, to help someone or to help yourself or to help a certain way of thinking, or you have to accept it first, and then you can help that part of you that is suffering and feeling that way. But if you push it away, you know, then it's just pure rejection. It takes a lot of energy, you know, and it actually creates a lot of pain for you. So it's better to accept it and then try to help. And that's as a good parent, that's what good parents do. You know, they accept and then accept their child, whatever the problem is. And then they do whatever they can to make it better. Acceptance first. That takes a huge pressure off your mind and allows the kind of the ananda, the wholeness. That just that act itself, that welcoming, that's love. And love manifests in that attitude. No rejection. The sannyasa vow of ahimsa, non-injury, it's called abhayam, is also to me a beautiful manifestation of love. And what that vow is, every sannyasi, when they take the sannyasa, the renunciation, the vow is, let me not be afraid of any being, and let no being be afraid of me. If you contemplate on that, but not being afraid of any being means I accept you. You know? And then I accept you. Then I can act objectively on what needs to be done, what's appropriate in that situation, but I accept you. And if I accept you, then you won't be afraid of me. So it's a double-sided, but it's very profound, I think. So let me not be afraid of any being, and let no being be afraid of me. No. But for no being to be afraid of you, you have to be able to not reject them. That doesn't mean acting out in a negative way. It means not rejecting, accepting them, welcoming them, and then objectively doing what is appropriate. What is the dharma in the situation? Yeah. Swamiji is a great master. He's such a master that he doesn't even realize he's a master. I've been this way so long. He can say yes or no to anyone at any time in a way that is absolutely welcoming and non-rejecting. So if something's not appropriate, we shouldn't do that. It's not something that should be done. He can say no, let's not do that. That's not going to work right now. He'll do it. He'll say these no's in such a way that you're totally included. You don't even feel like anybody said no to you. You know, you don't feel it at all, because he includes you in the no. You know what I mean? And his yeses also are like that. There's no rejection. There's no fanfare. There's just kind of objectivity. Like, how would this work? What would be good about this? You know. Or if he doesn't personally want to do something, he can't do it. Like, maybe they want him to go to an event. He'll say, "I can't do that now. Maybe later we can do it. I'm not able to do it now. Maybe later we can do it. We'll see." You know. The thing about this is that there comes a tremendous freedom for you and your own loving nature. The stability of your loving nature means a mind that's not tense, is learning how to say no. Because people don't, including myself, I'm relatively good at this now, but you don't want to say no, you don't want to hurt the person's feeling, all of this kind of stuff, because you don't know how to say no properly. You're afraid to say no, you know, because it feels like that's a rejection. It's not a rejection at all. It's just no. It's not a rejection. It's just that won't work for you right now. See what I mean? But that is a skill. It's called Kaushalam. When we're learning this karma yoga, so, you know, karma yoga, and I'll talk more about this, I'm sure, but it's karma yoga, that karma yoga buddhi where I take the results of all of my actions as that prasad from Bhagavan, from the Lord. Okay? That's only one part of it. The other part is Kaushalam. Kaushalam means knowing how to behave skillfully in the world, in my interactions with others. To have some skill in my interaction. And this is one good example of it, you know, how to be able to be totally with somebody, to have them totally included in your life because you know how to say no. Otherwise you get rid of the whole person because you don't know how to say no. So, yeah, that's all kind of tangential to but importantly tangential to the love question. Here's it all.
Question regarding the value of values and the book that Pujya Swami has written on that.
Yeah.
We give that to all of our yoga students,
yeah,
in the teacher training and follow it over the year and read it. And one thing that comes up from time to time is that people sort of interpret the values with guilt, seeing I'm not living up to this, and then put some guilt on themselves.
Yeah.
And I wonder if Radha could speak a little bit about that and how to avoid that. And present it in a way that doesn't come up.
I think I can get into a little bit more of type of inner child work, in a sense, that, like, when we say when you're a child, for instance, if you don't do something quite well enough, or you don't do something quite right, you know, then your parents can have different ways of dealing with that. Right? One can be, you're a bad child and you should never have done that. You should feel terrible about yourself in one way or another, you know? And so then the child feels bad and guilty for being, have done such a terrible thing, you know? There's another way, and so we can even, depends, like a person who feels guilty, how are you talking to yourself around that so-called failure or not, your inability to do something the way you would have liked to do it? You know, you can't talk to yourself as a failure, somebody who's a bad person, or somebody who is doing this and you should never have done that, and what kind of person are you that would do all this, you know, all this kind of stuff. In fostering guilt, right? Instead of when you've done something that is not up to your, how you want to be, you know, then what you do is, what if the parent, you the parent or the wise one inside says, looks at it totally different than that and say, okay, now, I didn't do it quite how I want to do it this time. Now, how can we improve that next time? And you look at the situation, how you responded, and say, how do I want to respond? And then you imagine it. Next time I'm going to do like this. Right? Next time I would like to respond like this. And then it becomes, you look at it more as a learning experience or a mastery on your way to Antakarana Shuddhi, that purity of mind. Each incident, you say, okay, this is just causing me pain. This is not what I want. Then what do you want? Then you visualize and say, okay, let me try next time to do like this. Then you've created an auto-suggestion in yourself, and the next time it comes up, you still may not do it perfectly, but it's probably a little better because that auto-suggestion of how you want to do has come up because you're training yourself. And so what if you looked at it more as training rather than training? It's like an athlete, say a tennis player, because I like tennis, so Swamiji loves tennis. You know, imagine how many thousands of times a tennis player practices their serve. Has anybody played tennis? How many thousands of times it takes to practice the serve to get anything that looks like a serve? You know? It's amazing. It's amazing that people can even do it. I play a little bit, not anything great, believe me, but it took me a long time to be able to do a serve. But I kept trying, you know, and I had somebody teaching and I kept trying and trying. Why don't we look at it like that? Look at our mind and our emotional structure in that way, where we're working on it because we have a value. We have a value for a certain value and we want our mind to achieve that. And sometimes in certain areas our mind may be quite away in terms of its habitual behavior, might be away from that value that we want to achieve. And so we can look at it very positively, you know, as exercise. It's an exercise. And slowly but surely, you know, your mind definitely achieves these values to where they become natural for you. So that's a very healthy way, because you have a value for the value, and so that's your task, is to practice it until you achieve it. But somehow we've, especially in the West, I guess, I don't know, we've had this idea that we have a value for a value, and so we should be perfect at that without putting in the time to achieve that, as though there should be no learning, that there should be no time has to be put in. If we're not already that, we're a bad person. Mm-hmm. It's totally false. It's totally unrealistic. It has nothing to do with reality. And yet we're imposing that on us. And then we feel like we're a deficient person. And that isn't true at all. We're not nothing. We are certainly not a deficient person. We're a person who is trying to live up to these beautiful values, trying to grow. That's what we're doing. And so we should be very, very supportive and very proud of that little one inside who's working to become a beautiful person. It requires, you know, love and praise and encouragement and respect, because those parts of us that are are trying to grow and live up to these values until they become natural. They do become natural, especially with knowledge, they become natural. Because it's easy to have a value for these values and to live out those values when your ananda and wholeness is not at stake. Yeah. So, and it's hard to be kind to others also when you're judgmental to yourself. You know? But when you give to others what you give to, can give to yourself. And all, but of course, a lot of times you give much more latitude to other people than you do to yourself. Yeah. But it's false. You give them the latitude, but it's not pure. It's not pure unless you give 360 degrees that value. Otherwise, it's a little phony, a little bit phony there. Because you're not wholly present to it. Does that make sense? Because you have a complex around it. I would say one thing now. Learning for those of us who are, most of us I think are vegetarian and some are even vegan. Being vegetarian and then in the end going all the way and being vegan. Being vegan means that you really cause no harm to living beings. You don't kill them for their leather or their wool. You know, you don't put living beings, you don't put them to death for your own well-being. You don't put them in harm's way for your own well-being, for your own ice cream or your own leather shoes or whatever is socially acceptable, whatever things make your life easy. You say, no, I'm not going to do that anymore. That's ahimsa. That is, ahimsa is really the highest value in terms of dharma. And so it's the overarching, with dharma, we put it at the top. What is really dharma is ahimsa, non-injury. And then we have to go into all kinds of details about, well, what about ahimsa in this situation, in this situation, this, you know, so it becomes complex, really. And in some situations, ahimsa is very difficult to determine what is really the best thing to do in this particular situation, but all of it comes, it starts with ahimsa, and then underneath a little bit more elaboration on ahimsa, non-injury, non-killing, non-harming, is the golden rule. The golden rule, which they have also in India in the Sanskrit, which I don't remember, but I remember in the English translation, do unto others as you would have done to yourself, which we know, that's very Western. And don't do to others as you would not have done to you. So that is very profound as a guiding rule to have bring in both sides of it. Mm-hmm. Do to others as you would want done to yourself. Treat them in that way. And don't treat them in a way that you would not want to be treated. And then extend that to all beings. Not just to your family members or to the human race, but to all species, to all beings. And as you cross that line over into that world of ahimsa, it changes you inside. Because unconsciously, even though unwittingly, because of what? Thousands upon thousands of years of ahimsa being just an integral part of our culture, we are carrying a pressure, an unconscious pressure, of that harm that we do to living beings. It's not that we don't know. We do know, but we keep it away. We're able to, the marketing masters keep it all away from us. Culture keeps it away from us. Every week, meat is packaged, leather shoes are nicely presented, not as dead animals, but as beautiful footwear, you know. So what is actually taking place is kept away from us on a conscious level. It is not kept away from us on an unconscious level. We know. We know, and we even, for most people, we even know that we know. But we can't let our, we know that we know, but we can't let ourselves know because there's too much sacrifice. It's a hassle it's a hassle to take ahimsa to its appropriate level. There's too much sacrifice involved. It's too hard. You know, going to a shoe store, there's nothing but leather shoes. You look at vegan shoes and you don't like them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or it goes on and on and on. You try to get some shoes that, oh, these look like they might be vegan, but they all have leather trim. And it goes literally on and on, even for your purses, your clothes. They have leather trappings and what, you know, all of these type of things. So, and then if you go to, say you're traveling, like when I travel, I take my own food for the most part. Because if you go to any restaurant, if you can, in an airport, you can't find anything that's not loaded with, laced with cheese. You know, and say you're vegan, then you're not eating dairy, you're not eating eggs, anything. And so it's not an easy thing. So once you become vegan is actually a moral commitment of non-injury. It's a commitment of non-injury. That's the only way a person can do it, really, because otherwise I think people do it for a while and they stop doing it because the culture is really not supporting you. So there has to be an inner commitment to non-injury that's very important to you. But when you make that commitment, there's a certain dharma that comes, all of the pieces inside come together. You know, the psyche kind of comes together in some way that's supportive. I don't know, it's like it becomes proper. There's something proper that's happening. And you're a friend then to all beings. You're a friend to all animals. You're a friend to the cows and you're a friend to all beings. And you feel very happy, you know. And that's what stops you from breaking down and getting that cheese sandwich or that, you know, egg salad sandwich because there aren't any other sandwiches available. You feel happy to sacrifice because you know what is being done to those animals and you want nothing to do with it. And you feel in solidarity with all beings. It's a hard thing until you get used to it. It's a hard thing to do until you get used to it. But the rewards are very, very great because you start coming in line with ahimsa. It's an amazing, amazing thing. I was vegetarian since I was about 18, but I've only been vegan for a few years now, a couple of years, that's all. I never let it go to, I didn't really eat eggs, but I did have, you know, cheese and that kind of thing until I started in milk. Like my lattes and all that, until I really studied what was happening to the cows, what really goes on with the cows in dairy. When you start studying this and getting more involved in it and you start understanding what goes on in the leather industry and you start opening your eyes and you make a decision, I cannot have anything to do with this. And as you make these decisions, the unconscious things that you've been holding back because you didn't want to deal with it, you're released from that, the bondage of those adharmas that you've been trying to avoid knowing about. Just talking from experience. But not just my experience, so many other people talk about this too. It's an important thing to contemplate on and consider. It reminds me of the lemming, Swamiji's lemming story. Yeah, it's because you do have to turn around and say, no, I'm not going that way. And everybody thinks, what? You say, no, I'm not. I will not. I will not go that way. Yeah. But you have a reason. The reason is ahimsa. The reason is that antakarna shuddhi, that mind that is free from harm. And then there's a lot of ripple down effects from that. Because then it's easier for you also to become more compassionate to human beings. That's a funny thing. But becoming compassionate to human beings also becomes more important than it was, because you realize that we're all beings. Once you include the animals as living beings, then you also are included in that. We're all in this, we're all living beings. And so somehow your compassion toward your fellow human animals, you know, also increases. It's really amazing. It's an amazing thing, and it's not easy for people to have their minds wake up to that place where you have to confront this. You know, you can keep it, buried for such a long time, but there can come a time when you have to look at it and make a decision. We're very good at not looking at it. The world is very good at not looking at it.
Right. But do you think it's tied into issues with your parents and your family? Because if I go there, then I can't, you know, I can't go back and eat with the family. You know, I mean, it's one thing to say I'm not eating meat, but why you're not eating cheese? Or we can't feed, you know, and they'll get so upset. People will say, oh, it's almost like hurting them more.
Yeah.
Than if I have the cheese or whatever.
Yeah.
But what can you say on that?
I know. you have to work out something.
Yeah.
I don't know, my parents wouldn't have cared, actually.
Mm-hmm.
They would just kind of roll their eyes, okay, well, that's what she's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. But I think that with my siblings, it's probably, except for my sister, Marianne, the other ones, you know, two of them would be okay with two of them would think, well, what are we going to do with her now? You know?
Mm-hmm.
You know? But I'll just say, don't worry, I always have something to eat. I can always find something to eat. Don't even think about it.
But do you feel that those the issues, maybe being able to let go of the cheese, for example, too, is tied in. Maybe I'm stretching it, but to the mother and father and that the approval and.
You know, I mean, I think it could be, it definitely could be because it's so much a part of life. But I think once you start evaluating that there's no blame to the parents because they also totally accept it as food. We've all totally accepted this as food. And even in the food pyramid, so the dairy, cheese, milk, all of this, and meat, all very important part of the food pyramid, which is slowly changing. That's all political. Food pyramid's so political, it's so corporate. But now it's going through modifications. Now they're starting to say you should really not eat milk, drink milk. You know why? Because it takes all of your calcium out of your bones. Now, why did your mom always make you drink milk? You need to have your milk for calcium, right? So many things are being discovered about the negative properties of dairy and meat. It's starting to come out now, and the meat industry, of course, is going crazy. So is the, you know, and poultry. Oh my gosh, I mean, it's heartbreaking to look into it. But we should look into it. We should look into it and become more conscious and not run away from the reality. We have to face the reality and then we have to make our choices having faced the reality. You know? And there probably are all kinds of lots of, you know, intertwined psychological reasons and parental reasons and yeah.
When you have chickens in your garden and you treat them really well, and they have good life, do you think it's still wrong to have their eggs? I mean, when the animal have a really good life.
Well, I know what you mean. I would probably feel the same way as what you're saying. The chickens, of course, don't want their eggs to be taken, and the roosters go crazy when the eggs are taken. You know, but say...
No,
if they don't seem to be bothered by it, you know. But then the question is, you can do that, then you should see whether eggs are actually good for you. That would be a good thing to study.
Mm.
And then you take those, you feel that it's ahimsa to take the eggs, the chickens are happily giving them to you, giving some of them to you, you feel okay. But the argument that I give these, my cows, such a good life up until they're slaughtered, or I give, you know, they have a wonderful life and I slaughter them as humanely as possible, and they have outdoor grazing and everything, and they all have their names, they all have a beautiful life, you know. And same with the chickens, I can say, you know, I raise them so beautifully, they all have names, we love our chickens, and then, you know, one by one we slaughter them when we need them.
Mm.
Some goats, etc., all of that.
Mm.
We don't accept that. It would be like that doing to others, do you want to be raised really humanely and then slaughtered? Or, well, yeah, I would prefer to be raised really well, taken really well, and then slaughtered than being raised and hurt and tortured and then slaughtered. But do I want to be slaughtered? No. Do I want that outcome of being slaughtered? Absolutely no. And do you think that all of these animals, whether they're raised well or they're raised murderously, you know, want in the end to be slaughtered? And they're terrified. So I've seen all sorts of videos on this. Also, there's a video out called Cowspiracy. It's really good. I showed this to my students at CIS. And they show this one, in this one section, these farmer, really very hip couple with their two or three children, who are raising cattle, and they raise them very humanely. They have free grazing, and they're all cared for extremely well, and they all have names, you know, and the children love them, and in the end, they're humanely slaughtered. And the questioner, who was not attacking in any way, was just questioning them, what is that like? You know, you've raised them, you have a relationship with them, and then you slaughter them. What is it like? And they became really quiet and really uncomfortable, and they kind of couldn't look up. And then they kind of said something like, I don't remember, you should watch the film. They said, yeah, it's very, very hard. You know? But they were not comfortable at all. It's like, and you could see the hurt in the children. The children were there too. Their pets. They'd become their pets, you know? And then they're slaughtered. How would you feel? You don't want to be slaughtered. They truly don't want to be slaughtered. It's not like they're happily going to the slaughterhouse. They really are not. You know, it's the same with the pigs. It's unimaginable. It's unimaginable cruelty. And so we have to, as humans, we have this human birth. We've taken control all over all of these living beings, you know. So now we have to do our dharma. But to do our dharma, you have to get out of this haze, this marketing haze that has held us at bay from any type of dealing with the reality. You know? And then we have to, you know, be maverick lemmings.
Mm-hmm.
I love this, Maverick Lemmings. I so many of Bhavishanas. He has all these things, you know. Then they all go into my repertoire. I always give him credit. I always give him credit. But they're so good. This is a good, great one.
I have a question. Talking about this being not vegan, not vegetarian, I feel a lot of issues, because I, as you say, I know this is true, but it's very difficult for me, because I think I need this, I think I need that, and I also have the parents that, you know, would go crazy if I would stop eating cheese and everything. But I grew up on a farm, and
yeah.
I had pet lambs, and I was, you know, they were my friends, and come autumn, they would be slaughtered, and I would have to eat them. And I remember tears streaming down my face and ending up on the plate, and I had to eat it. I was forced to do it. And so my question is really, all these feelings that we have that makes us human, feeling of sadness, feeling of anger, and feeling this, you know, this is too hard to really take in, they are hindering to get to the Supreme Self.
We have to learn how, it's true, they are like what we call pratibandhakas. They act as kind of obstructions, but they won't, once you're willing to face them and accept them. Mm-hmm. And accepting your hurts and pain and sorrow, mm-hmm. you know, to be able to accept it and be with it in a loving, comforting way allows all of that to come through. Mm-hmm. You know, I know for myself, in terms of the vegan thing, I wish so much that I had never touched meat, ever. Never. That I had never eaten any dairy, that I had never gotten near any leather. I wish that I had understood. I wish that I'd never, and I, in my heart, I just apologize. I may apologize once a day. I'm just so sorry. Because now I know. And all of that time, I was knowing without knowing, knowing without letting myself know. Some of it I actually didn't know at all. But a lot of it I knew without letting myself know because of the inconvenience or just not wanting to bother or whatever. You know? And Swamiji used to, when I was growing up with him, every yajna, whenever he would go all around India and in the United States, he would always give maybe a 20 or 30 minute talk during the yajna about being a vegetarian. He would give all kinds of examples, and I would think, oh, here we go. Mm-hmm. You know? Even though I was vegetarian at that time, but I was like, why is Swamiji, why does he always talk about being a vegetarian? Why is he always doing it? Is it really necessary? You know? And then, on top of that, whenever in Salersburg, my brother and sister would always come down to visit Swamiji, and they weren't vegetarian at all. And Swamiji always, he just loved them, he loved to see them, you know. And he would always give, be like $100. And he'd say, you take them out, because he was afraid they wouldn't want Indian food, they might want to go to a nice restaurant. I'd say, oh, you take them out. I'd say, okay, Swamiji, tell them I want you to take them out. So every time that they came, I would take them to this Snydersville diner or something, you know. And they would have their, you know, hamburgers and omelets and steak and eggs and whatever. They were vegetarian, you know. And so whenever I would come back, Swamiji would say, did you take them out? You know, and then he'd always go, what did they eat? I said, Swamiji, please don't ask me that. Don't ask me that. And then he'd go, okay, I'm sorry. Oh, yes. Next time, same thing. What did they eat? And it wasn't, and this went on, for 20 years, since 1984, this has been going on. Every year, you know. It's just something that he did. And they didn't, my brother especially, they had very little money. They just made it through the month, you know. And so it was a big thing. It wasn't until maybe 2 or 3 years ago that I realized that what I should have done, and now I regret, you know, in a kind way to myself, I regret. I should have said, this is from Swamiji, we can go out to eat, but it has to be vegetarian because he's a vegetarian. So let's go and have a vegetarian meal, which is easy for me. I mean, it's vegetarian, it's nothing. That's so easy. There's plenty of vegetarian food. It's vegan. It's a little harder. Yeah. I wish I would have done that. Then I could have gone back to Swamiji and I could have said, Swamiji, we had a wonderful meal. It was all vegetarian. Even though they're not vegetarian, they eat vegetarian for Swamiji. And they really enjoyed it. And Swamiji would have been so happy. That thought never crossed my mind. In all of these years, I've been with Swamiji 44 years, that thought never crossed my mind that I could have done that. And that my family would have been, they love Swamiji, they would have been so happy. Okay, let's find something vegetarian. It would have been a challenge for them. You know, they would have loved to do that. And Swamiji would have been so thrilled. And I wonder if he was always asking me to think if I would ever, in my mind, just come across that little thought. You know, nope, didn't happen. Isn't that funny? It's not very funny, sad, but... And I don't blame myself. It's just shocking. It's shocking that thought would not occur to me. Because if it would have occurred to me, I would have thought, oh, that's a good idea, but no. That's the amount of conditioning that we have. It's just astounding.
Is it one of the points that implicitly you're making, that Swamiji is so embraces every person, every situation with so much love that he doesn't even suggest or push on his wishes to avoid to influence or
no,
to avoid?
Not exactly, because he talks about being vegetarian a lot, you know, but he would never push it, something on a person, like a commandment, you should be vegetarian. He will not do that. He will say it in a lecture, and he'll talk about it in an objective way, but he won't make a commandment to you, because you may not be ready to follow it, and then you'll feel guilty. Especially in India, if Swamiji says you have to do something, then you have to do it, or you would feel really guilty. So he won't do that. See what I mean? But that doesn't mean that he'll not try to educate you so that you understand, so that he'll put those values, like the value of values, the whole value of values. I give that book to all my students too at CIS, in the spiritual counseling class. I love that. They love it too. They love that book. You know, that value of values is what he tries to do, is give you a value for the value, and then you yourself can grow into that as you can, you know. But say nobody's trying to give you a value for the value, then all these unconscious things that are kept away from us, we just kind of swim in that adharma without our mind being able to come to the surface to see it until it does. I mean, I feel like, wow, I mean, how could have I made it clear into my 60s without making that, without crossing over? Or even... I even remember thinking about being vegan as, wow, these people are really extreme. I thought they were just extremists. It never, for so long it was like that. They were just extreme people, you know, radicals, too radical, impractical. What are they doing, you know? I didn't understand. It was still... completely underwater. That's the one thing that's just a, kind of a fresh example for me. I'm sure, you know, as we grow, there's different things in our own ways of being that all of a sudden we realize, you know, that you want to change because you've kind of come out of the darkness around that particular value. And then you change around that because you gain a value for it. That happens when it happens. And until it does, you're kind of just going along. But there, internally, there's a big difference. Whether known or unknown, when you're living out of value, your psyche comes into much more shanti. Even if you're not living out of value because of just unconsciousness. But still the psyche suffers from that. Suffers from that unconscious adharma. To understand it really, Swamiji's used this example, if you put your hand in fire, it's going to burn whether you know it or not. You know, if you put it in unconsciously, you will be burned. If you put it in consciously, you'll be burned. Because fire burns by its very nature. And a dharma creates dissonance by its nature, whether you're aware of it or not. In terms of what we call drishtapala. Drishtapala is the immediate effect of that a dharmic act, you get an immediate result that you experience. You may not know why you're not feeling so good, you know, because you don't, you're unconscious of the particular adharma, but it's kind of just a one quick sentence on that. Well, your feelings of hurt and sadness and despair, all of the negative spectrum of feelings that we have, we can look at those as symptoms of an illness, you know. And so take each one of those feelings, you know, take them seriously and talk to them. We'll do some meditations around this. Talk to them to find out what it is that's really bothering them. If you have, like, as though they were a little person, you know, say, what it is, what is it really that's causing you so much despair? What is it that's really bothering? And if you're kind in that your approach, in that kind of inner dialogue, if you're kind and not attacking, those parts of yourself will often tell you. You know? Otherwise, we're feeling despair and we look around us and everything, nothing's good. This is how it is. You know? But we're not looking at it and taking it seriously as a symptom and letting it talk to us and kind of following the thread back to what is really hurting us. It's really interesting. It's really helpful to start to learn how to follow these threads back, the threads of our feelings, you know, including the threads of our happiness. What is it that makes the mind feel so happy or so loving? You can say, why are you so happy now? What's going on? Because just from the standpoint of the vritti, thought modification, you know, like, why has that clarity come? What has happened to allow for that clarity? So it's nice to find that out and let your psyche will talk to you if you ask. So. Okay, we should stop. Now, I can never do Vagisha's insert in the universal prayer that we do. So I'll just, when you go ahead and do it, then I'll hook on. Okay? Because the prayer that's been handed out doesn't have that part in it, but he does. Because I don't know.
The last part.
Sarve Sham.
Yeah. I'll just switch over when you do it, okay? Because I don't automatically do it. Om Tat Sat.
Swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha ko brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini Desho yam kshobharahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayah Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pasyantu, ma kaschit dukkha bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya, Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harih Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harih Om.